of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ صَبَرُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ أُولَئِكَ لَهُم مَّغْفِرَةٌ وَأَجْرٌ كَبِيرٌ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Projections suggest that Republicans will take control of the U.S. House of Representatives as vote counting continues in U.S. midterm elections. A convoy carrying fuel from Iran to Lebanon reportedly comes under attack on the Iraq-Syria border. And Iran reiterates its readiness to help settle the existing disputes between Armenia and Azerbaijan, saying foreign forces cannot solve the problems of the Caucasus. Hello and welcome to World News at our headquarters in Tehran. Many thanks for joining us. Vote counting is underway in the US midterm elections. Results will determine the balance of power in the Senate and House of Representatives, as projections suggest Democrats could lose control of both chambers to Republicans. The battle for the Senate control is on a knife edge. There are 100 seats up for grabs in the chamber, with no party currently holding the lead. However, Republicans will be able to take control of the Senate if they manage to pick up only one seat. As for control of the House of Representatives, Republicans are in the lead as well. 435 seats are up for grab. A shift in power in the chambers would make Democratic President Joe Biden a lame duck for his remaining 2 years in office. Colin Campbell joined us earlier for an update. He explained how Americans feel about the outcome of the elections.
So in Washington right now, a lot of people are anxious about the outcome of this election. You had a president who came in thinking that he had a mandate to build America better, fix infrastructure, deal with some of the racial inequities here, deal with some of the issues dealing with some of the more marginalized communities across the country. You also had to deal with the abortion issue, which became an issue during his presidency when the Supreme Court overturned the Roe versus Wade ruling, something that was established in the early 70s. So now you have people on the president's political side, Democrats, saying we have to show up at the polls. At the same time, though, historically, whatever party is in power usually suffers some type of losses during the midterm elections. This was supposed to be augmented, especially during Biden's time in office because he's not a very popular president. He has a low approval rating. Congress has a low approval rating. So there was expected to be a lot of Republicans just wiping out Democrats. And therefore, it would be a huge loss for Biden and his political allies. What we're looking at, however, is a divided Congress if everything that is occurring now holds true when the final votes come in. This will make it extremely difficult for the president to pass any cogent policy alluding to anything that he had promised on the campaign trail.
Reports coming out of the Iraq-Syria border say two tankers carrying fuel have come under attack. At least four explosions reportedly rocked the Al-Qayyum border crossing early on Wednesday. Iraqi media have quoted intelligence sources as saying that the tankers were carrying Iranian oil to Lebanon, adding the explosions left no casualties. While some local sources said the attack was a drone strike, an Iraqi source speaking on condition of anonymity say the attack was carried out by the Israeli regime. Iran has reiterated its readiness to help solve the existing problems between Azerbaijan and Armenia, stressing Tehran's respect for the territorial integrity of its neighbors. Foreign Ministry spokesman said Iran's principled policy is based on maintaining good relations with all its neighbors. Nasser Kanani said Tehran supports a peaceful settlement of differences between Baku and Yerevan within the framework of international law. He said problems in the Caucasus must be solved by regional countries as foreign forces will not help resolve those issues. He added that a recent military exercise by Iranian armed forces in the country's northwest was a regular move and Iran's neighbors had been informed in advance. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton has talked about the recent riots in Iran, saying, quote, "Protesters were armed with weapons smuggled from the Iraqi Kurdistan region." Bolton made the remarks in an interview with the BBC Persian TV channel. He characterized the rioters as opposition and said he had seen images of some protesters being trained and armed in Iraq's Kurdistan region. Earlier, Iran's Border Guard Command announced the seizure of 5,000 pieces of U.S.-made cold weapons at the border. The commander of the Border Force, General Ahmad Ali Gudarzi, said over 600 firearms, including pistols and rifles, were also discovered and seized over the past 45 days. Protests erupted in several Iranian cities in September after a young woman fainted at a police station and was pronounced dead in hospital later. The protests were initially peaceful but soon turned into riots and vandalism. Said Mohammad Marandi is a professor at the University of Tehran. He says terrorist groups themselves admit to have an active role in the recent riots in Iran.
They admit openly, or they claim that they are active inside Iran, and they claim to be leading the riots. So there's no surprise when people are seen. Photos are taken, footage is taken of people using knives, slitting police officers by the throat, shooting and killing other police officers and Besij members, burning people alive, and then simultaneously being glorified in Western countries and in the Western media as freedom fighters, and Persian language media based in London calling their acts of murder, of burning people alive, of brutality against the police as legitimate. And if these media outlets were in English, Ofcom would, and they were directed towards an English audience or an English country or British English speaking country, Ofcom would shut these television stations down immediately and put these people on trial.
Iran's new version of indigenously made missile defense system Bavar 373 is capable of hitting targets just 5 minutes after fire. As Salman Khujuri reports, the missile system has made Iran among only five countries in the world with such a highly sophisticated technology.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs 3 different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Israeli forces carry out a new attack in the occupied West Bank, killing one more Palestinian man in the city of Nablus. Israeli forces shot dead 18-year-old Mahdi Mohammed Hashash during an early morning raid in Balata camp. 3 other Palestinians were seriously injured and taken to the hospital. Israel has recently tightened its deadly grip on the occupied West Bank and widened its crackdown on Palestinians there. More than 140 people have lost their lives in the West Bank this year alone. Palestinians have repeatedly called on the international community to help end the Israeli blitz in the occupied territories. In Britain, strikes are planned to be held later in November amid an unprecedented rising inflation and a nationwide economic crisis. A strike by London Underground workers is set to go ahead on Thursday. Millions of passengers will face disruption in transportation. That's after authorities failed to resolve a contract dispute with workers. Officials have cautioned passengers that limited or no service will be expected on Thursday. The workers are demanding pay rise to help soften the blow of inflation that has already gone up to double-digit levels. Meanwhile, more than 70,000 university staff at 150 universities across the country will strike for 3 days over working conditions and pensions. The strike is set to take place on the 24th, 25th and the 30th of November. Eurozone finance ministers meet in Brussels to exchange views on the EU's worsening energy crisis. Governments in the bloc have so far failed to mitigate the economic costs associated with cutting off Russia's cheap gas supplies. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
Tourists are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the Eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the Eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the Eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes at the Council of the EU, Brussels.
Washington and Moscow have agreed to hold meetings under the New START nuclear arms reduction treaty. The US State Department spokesman Ned Price says a bilateral consultative commission will meet in the near future. Price was apparently referring to the mechanism for the implementation of the treaty. The US official did not specify a date or location for the meeting. The New START treaty took effect in 2011. It caps the number of strategic nuclear weapons the United States and Russia can deploy. In August, Moscow suspended its cooperation with inspections under the treaty. Russia blamed the move on travel restrictions imposed by Washington and its allies over the war in Ukraine. Moscow, however, said it was still committed to the compliance with the treaty's provisions. German journalist Alina Lipp is facing 3 years in prison in her home country for her coverage of crimes committed by Ukrainian forces against civilians. As our correspondent Johnny Miller finds out, German authorities are also persecuting Alina's mother simply for being her mother.
This is Petra Bass Lipp. She is the mother of Alina Lipp, a journalist whom the German government is trying to imprison due to her reporting in Donbass. Like her daughter, she has fled Germany to Crimea due to persecution. The government recently arbitrarily closed her bank account.
First her bank account, then her father's bank account, and last mine. So, yeah.
And what does that do, closing down your bank account?
What does it... You must imagine, you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So, what to do?
And the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case, they just didn't even tell you, they just shut it down?
No, they didn't tell me. No, nothing.
How did you survive?
Yeah, I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So the state told you that? The state told you to go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lipp for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order, a effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
Johnny Miller, Crimea.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
A new analysis finds that the U.S. war in Somalia was waged with no clear legal basis.
In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Intercept wrote, "The United States has fought more than a dozen secret wars over the last two decades. According to a new report from Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law, through a combination of ground combat, air strikes, and operations by U.S. proxy forces, these conflicts have ranged from Africa to the West Asia region to Central Asia, often completely unknown to the American people and with minimal congressional oversight. This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous," wrote Catherine Young Ebright, counsel in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. "The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations," she added. "These clandestine conflicts have been enabled by 2001 authorization for use of military force enacted in the wake of September 11 attacks, as well as the covert action statute, which allows secret, unattributed operations primarily conducted by the CIA. The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that The Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Ebright documents so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercury 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members. Congress says understanding of U.S. warmaking is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding the Department of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch. Ebright's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces, the Dana Brigade and the Puntland Security Force. The CIA began building the Puntland Security Force in 2002 to battle the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab, and later the State in Somalia, or ISS. The force was transferred to U.S. military control around 2012 and went on to fight alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces for a decade. In Puntland, we built that capability, training them at the tactical level and in how to support themselves and follow a good counterinsurgency strategy against Al-Shabaab. Don Bulldog, the former chief of Special Operations Command Africa and now the Republican candidate for Senate in New Hampshire, told The Intercept in a 2019 interview. Ebright notes that the proxy fighters were largely independent of the Somali government, despite being an elite armed brigade and one of Somalia's most capable special operations units. And their relationship with U.S. forces was long kept secret, with U.S. officials disavowing the presence of military advisors in Somalia until 2014. More troubling, the analysis suggests that for a significant period of time, there was no clear legal basis for U.S. military to fight alongside and direct these forces. The Obama administration designated Al-Shabaab an associated force of Al-Qaeda and thus a legitimate target under 2001 AUMF in 2016. That administration did the same for the ISS in 2014, but ISS has never been publicly identified as an ISIS-associated force by any administration. This means that the Pentagon developed and fought alongside the Puntland Security Force from 2012 and the Dana Brigade from 2011, under the 127E and 333 Security Cooperation Authorities, before the AUMF was judged to authorize hostilities against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, much less ISS. The Department of Defense is unequivocal that it does not treat 333 and 127E as authorizations for use of military force. The reality is not so clear, writes Ebright. After all, U.S. forces have used these authorities to create control and at times engage in combat alongside groups like the Puntland Security Force and Dana Brigade. Over the last 20 years, presidents have consistently claimed broad rights to act in self-defense, not only of U.S. forces, but also for partners like the Puntland Security Force and Dana Brigade, which Ebright notes potentially allows the U.S. to fight remote adversaries in the absence of any congressional authorization. Representative Jacobs said it was difficult to assure the military community in her San Diego district that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe when Congress has such little information, let alone oversight over when, where, and how we are using military force. Attempts to avoid scrutiny from Congress and Congress's own abdication of war powers is central to how we ended up in forever wars, the spike in civilian casualties, and failed strategies that waste taxpayer dollars and fuel very conflicts they are trying to solve. The report offers suggestions for improving congressional and public oversight, enforcing the balance of war powers within the government, and preventing hostilities unauthorized by Congress. Ebright writes, repealing 333, 127E, and 1202 would return the balance of power to where it stood before the so-called War on Terror. Forcing the Pentagon to convince Congress that building foreign proxies abroad is in the United States' national security interest. This is critical given that working by, with, and through foreign surrogates and allies is key to the Pentagon's global vision. According to the Biden administration's recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, both of those documents underscore that the DoD views security cooperation as the future of its approach, Ebright told Intercept, adding, "Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill and in the broader public, we don't have conversations about what this means, to the detriment of voters understanding where we are at war and how this is going to affect military involvement and entrenchment abroad."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Everything has been carefully planned for the annual New Year's greetings ceremony to the King. Government officials are all standing in line to perform the tradition of kissing the King's hand. But it seems someone special is absent from the ceremony. Iran is shocked and stunned with the news of a suicide. The suicide of well-known Qajar commander, Colonel Fazlullah. No one knows how the prime minister was notified of what had happened, but everyone saw his hasty exit from the New Year's greeting ceremony.
The first person who arrives at the scene is then Prime Minister Vosoukh Dole. His presence at the colonel's house is not that strange. What's strange, though, is that he personally inspects the scene and does not issue the burial permit until the discovery of the colonel's letter before he committed suicide. It's now 9 days since the beginning of the new year, but the colonel's suicide has still not been reported to the public. Finally, after 10 days, Vosoukh allows the coverage of the event, but only Raad newspaper is allowed to publish it, without mentioning a motive for the suicide. You have to look for the answer to the riddle in the note that the colonel had written before killing himself. What is the motive of the suicide? Why does Vosoukh prevent the publication of the news? The answer to these questions invites us to an exciting journey, a journey among historical records and documents. Media outlets which support the government try to circulate word that the suicide had a personal motive, and on the other hand, Vosoukh Dole has peace of mind that the people and media do not have access to the colonel's last letter. Until a document discovered at the mortuary shatters all of Vosoukh's calculations. A note soaked in blood in Colonel Fazlullah's shirt pocket. This document proves rumors that the suicide of Colonel Fazlullah and the agreement were related. Of course, it wasn't very difficult to confirm the connection. Less than 2 months since the publication of the agreement has passed and the British delegation enters Tehran. A delegation led by this man, General Dixon, an experienced officer in the British Army. Their mission has been defined, the establishment of a committee for the implementation of this article of the agreement. An article which lifts military sanctions on Iran and insists that it establishes a uniform military force. The meetings of the committees are held at this place with the presence of Colonel Fazlullah as the representative of Iran's army. During 4 months of talks, issues like the purchase of weaponry, of course from India's army, the unification of military forces, and the training of Iranian officers are discussed. But the results of lifting of the military sanctions is the purchase of light and used weapons remaining from World War, something that creates disagreements within the committee. The disagreement slowly turns into a problem when another issue is mentioned. It goes so far that Colonel Fazlullah is harshly confronted by the then Minister of War. This is what lies at the heart of the issue, the training of Iranian officers. It is approved that a number of sergeants will train Iranian officers, but these sergeants will not be coming to Iran from England, but from the Indian Army. And the officers can only be promoted to the rank of captain. Higher ranks must only be employed from the British Army. The colonel is faced with statutes that weaken Iran's army, something totally against the agreement. A familiar theme for the people of Iran, a difference between the text and essence of the agreement. The same had happened during the Goldsmith Treaty, the Paris Treaty, the Treaty of Turkmenchay, the Treaty of Golestan, and others. The colonel's objections are useless. He's chosen another way to make his voice of opposition heard. Suicide. Even though the colonel committed suicide only with the knowledge he had of the agreement's third article, he unveiled the oppressive nature of the agreement. That started the first of the protests and created an atmosphere which allowed the agreement to be exhaustively scrutinized.
This is how Sayed Hassan Modarres voices his criticism of the agreement. Things become so heated that nationalists and religious forces come together in opposing the agreement. Mohammad Mossadegh, using the keyword deception, begins to criticize the agreement. Nationalistic fervor soon reaches the southwest of Iran. The protests are centered here, in Tabriz. The bazaar is shut down by shop owners, schools are closed, and after scuffles, the gendarmerie is now under the control of the people. The leader of these protests is Sheikh Mohammad Khiabani, a well-known figure in Iran's political landscape. Vosokhodole's defense of the article gives the British the permission to employ their own people and infiltrate in any part of the government that they deem noteworthy. The protests in Tabriz are followed here by the founder of the jungle movement, Younes Ostad Sarayi, known as Mirza Kuchakhan Jangeli. In his newspaper called The Jungle Paper, he refers to the agreement as a document to sell Iran. This agreement also has monetary obligations. The people have to pay from their own pockets for the British to oppress them. Of course, it is framed as a loan to Iran in order to achieve articles of the agreement, which include employing the British in the government and the purchase of their used weaponry. This is how Abdullah Mostofi, the writer of the book, The Story of My Life, refers to the loan. Mirzadeh Eshqi criticizes the fourth article in the form of a poem. The agreement also has a solution for the improvement of public transportation in Iran. England generously agrees to it, to allow Iran to have a railway system. This article can be considered positive and in line with the development of Iran. But why does Iran even need the consent of England to have a railway system? And the basics of choosing a contractor for national projects is soliciting tender offers, not imposition by a certain country. In the last article of this agreement, England wants to free the customs services, an organization that is under their own occupation. Even if this article leads to its release, it is nothing but bargaining over an irrefutable right. As the protests continue, Farrokhi Yazdi also uses poetry as a sword to oppose the agreement and addresses Vosukh. But it's not only Farrokhi Yazdi and Mirzadeh Eshqi who use literature as a weapon to criticize the agreement. Yahya Dolat Abadi, Dehkhoda, Malik-ush-Shu'ara Bahar, and even Iraj Mirza write poems and contents in their opposition to the agreement. Of course, there was a price to pay for those with a critical pen. Mirzadeh Eshqi and Farrokhi Yazdi are imprisoned because of their poetry. Ordinary people joined the National Solidarity Movement by staging shutdowns and walkouts, sit-ins in mosques and streets, and unite against the agreement. This is Sheikh Abdul Hussein Mosque, the center of the protests in Tehran. In a controversial act, Vosukh orders an attack on a gathering at the mosque and 17 prominent figures are arrested. It seems as if Vosukh has lost control of the situation.
Sepah Square is near the mosque, and even the heavy rainfall cannot stop the people of Tehran from staging huge protests. Iran is drowning in the fury of the people. Protests are held in every single corner of the country. Everyone, regardless of their party and group affiliations, with any political and religious belief, is protesting against the agreement. Every single one wants only one thing, the annulment of the agreement. The signing of a secret agreement which was meant to lift sanctions and spin the wheels of the economy and politics in Iran showed its true colonial nature with the suicide of Colonel Fazlullah. The agreement now faces the widespread opposition of the people from every party, class, and status. It's an agreement that is bitter, but not the only one of its kind in Iran's history, which has been full of ups and downs. But it seems this agreement is somehow different from the ones before it. If only this was the end of it. Unfortunately, the story of the agreement does not end here. A sad story and its ending chapter is written not in Tehran, but somewhere 4,400 kilometers away, in a place in the Green Continent. A developed city with the River Thames flowing through it. It's exactly here, London. Not too far from the Big Ben clock tower, the editorial office of the Times. This is the exact location where the last page of the agreement is, in the newspaper's archives department. Among the masses of paper, an interesting headline can be seen. The headline of the agreement between Iran and England. What can be seen following the title is the details of the agreement. Details that are not very different from what we already know. But this newspaper reveals a huge mystery of the agreement for the first time. The answer to the mystery is not in its headline or the body of the article, but hidden in the top of the page. Exactly here, on top of the page, where the date of the paper is printed. August 16, 1919, which falls on Mordad the 24th, 1298 on the Iranian calendar. Take a look at the date of the publication of the agreement in Iran, the 17th of Shahrivar, 1298, which falls on September 9, 1919. The difference is obvious. This means that the agreement was signed at least 24 days before it was made public in Iran. But here's the question. When the agreement has already been signed, what was being negotiated during those 24 days? What delays the negotiation process? The answer can be found in this telegraph from British ambassador to Tehran. It seems what prolonged the negotiations was not the text of the agreement. The agreement has annexes too, and the bargaining was over these annexes. The closest I got to becoming successful in this mission was lowering the asking price to 400,000 tomans. To be fair, I must inform you that when it came to asking for money, Vosukhodole was not as unrelenting as the other two ministers, Nosratodole and Saremodole. They truly made life a living hell for me. It seems we have to accept a reason for the negotiations taking so long. A bribe. Years later, the bribe is attacked in an editorial in the Times by the opposition of the British government. We persuaded the Anglophile government of our own creation in Iran, and with the help of a bribe of £130,000 stolen from the British taxpayer, we wanted to popularize the Anglo-Persian agreement. The British people did not know about the bribe, but the Iranian population did. Aside from clarifying the sum of the bribe, the editorial also includes a bitter confession. The confession to the creation of an Anglophile government in Iran by the British themselves. In the court of history, these documents are witness that it was the British who caused the famine. The British who brought Vosukhodole to power and by sending Ahmad Shah off to Europe were busy colonizing Iran based on a completely calculated plan. The savior of Iran is the blood of Iranians like Colonel Fazlullah. A tragedy is a writing or a play which has a sad theme, and usually showcases miseries, physical and mental torture, and betrayal. After a century, we talked about the tragedy of the Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919. But how will history narrate the future tragedies of Iran?
In the limelight.
According to economists' forecasts, the American economic recession is certain within the next 12 months. Analysts say US President Joe Biden has not been able to fulfill his promises, and the economic conditions of the American people have worsened during his presidency. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of NBC News has more for us. A new opinion poll shows 43% of the American public say their family's financial situation is worse than 2 years ago, as inflation has made it harder for people to make ends meet. The new survey, released on Sunday, 6th of November, finds that the share has doubled since President Joe Biden took office last year on 20th of January, replacing Donald Trump. 43% of those who took part in the survey said their family's financial situation has worsened, but 39% said it has remained the same in the past 2 years, while 18% claimed it is better now. According to exit polling, only about 20% of voters said their financial situation had worsened at the time of the 2020 presidential election, compared to 4 years earlier when Donald Trump was elected. In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation reached a 40-year high in the final official reading. A report published recently on inflation showed prices in the United States are rising more than expected. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high inflation is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation. President Biden said in a statement on Friday, 4th of November, that inflation is a top economic challenge and claimed that he has a plan to bring down prices by lowering healthcare costs and energy costs. Joe Biden claimed the Republican plan is very different. They want to increase prescription drug costs, health insurance costs, and energy costs while giving more tax breaks to big corporations and the very wealthy. Here's the deal: cutting corporate taxes and allowing big pharma to raise prices again is the Republican inflation plan, and it's a disaster. With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively is losing almost an entire day's pay, and that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers, and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma: stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The website Politico has more for us. According to a new Morning Consult poll, nearly two-thirds of registered voters believe the U.S. economy is currently in a recession. About 65% of respondents indicated they believe the economy is already in a recession, compared to 22% who said the opposite. 14% didn't know or had no opinion. Republicans were more likely to consider the economy to be in a recession, with 81% saying so, compared to 63% of independents and 51% of Democrats. Concerns about an economic slowdown have grown as the U.S. Federal Reserve continues aggressively hiking interest rates, which increases borrowing costs to lower inflation by cooling off demand. Analysts and economists are confident the U.S. Federal Reserve will announce a hike in its baseline interest rate range of another 0.75 percentage point, which would mark the fourth consecutive increase at the aggressive pace. U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has indicated the central bank will keep increasing interest rates until inflation shows clear signs of falling. But progressive Democrats are increasingly ripping Jerome Powell for risking job losses as a result of the moves. The hikes already have caused rising mortgage rates and a steep decline in home sales.